Amy Snowden is incredible. She's the brains behind Lego Pharma and has just spent the last couple of years travelling around the globe, immersing herself in food culture and learning everything she can about agricultural engagement. She's now keen to share her findings with Australia. Hello, Amy.
Welcome to the Behind the Collective podcast. I'm going to kickstart with the hardest question of them all. Describe yourself in three words.
Thanks, Tiff, and thanks for having me on. Yes, I started off with a nice tricky question. I'm going to say determined because I don't want to say stubborn, creative and patient because I work with children.
I like that. And I reckon from what I know of you, you'd have to be all three. Now, I've been following you afar for years, and I'm sure lots of people have, or, you know, would have heard of you and your work with the Lego Pharma. And I'm going to, this is another really big question, but why do you do what you do? What's inspired you to be you and do the work you do around ag education and in that space?
I guess I fell into ag education from my own passion and connection, but I grew up on a Lucerne hay farm and we're in an irrigation area and we're not the most loved people in the world, being New South Wales irrigators. And so I came at it as a place for the Lego farmer, particularly as a place of connection. So it was a way of sharing the diversity of Australian agriculture. I'm really proud of what we do, not only on our farm, but in our district, but also the innovation that comes out of Aussie Ag. And I just wanted a way to share it. I didn't at the time when I started it think it was going to be anything big, or it was just kind of a way of going, you know, to friends and family, hey, look at what we do. Like, this is actually kind of cool. And that led into that connection piece, and that became passion for ag education. And so from that ag education, I guess what gets me really excited and really passionate is those kids that we're working with are our future consumers. They're going to be the ones making the decisions in 20 or 30 years' time, but they are so curious and inquisitive, and their questions are amazing, and they get me excited every day. I love watching them learn. I love watching, you can see when the light bulb ticks over for something and they work something out, and just discovering where their food and fiber comes from. And I think it's cool that that's what I get to do.
What always takes you by surprise, not just students, but I suppose anyone, you know, through the work you do, you'd be having a lot of conversations around ag. Is there a particular question, or has there been a question which you've just been like, oh, wow?
I guess when it comes to working with kids, they have no filter. They love to know. And so for me, it's their transparency. They want to know paddock to plate. So they're always asking, how does things work? How do things grow? They want to know that next step. So what happens at a meat processing center? How does this food actually get to my plate? And they're curious. They just want to know. I guess we tend to sometimes make it politically correct, or I try to skip over some steps for them, but they want to know the details and they're really, really curious because that's how life works. But you can guarantee if you take a group of kids out to a farm, the first question they will ask the farmer is, do they have a dog and what is the dog's name?
I love that. And I think through, like, I suppose the work we do, and I haven't even asked you to explain even that just yet, but we are exposed to so many more consumers. I think, like, I know I've been at ag shows and the Royal Show for a week recently. And I think we almost sometimes think that there's just like this complete lack of interest, but there is so many people, and we get bogged down a little bit as an industry, I think, thinking, oh my gosh, it's us and it's them, and they don't know what they're talking about. But it's incredible. People, there is a huge amount of people who genuinely want to know the story behind their food, in particular kids, but there's people out there, and we have that ability to go and talk to them and see them and really, I suppose, be forward facing with that. And I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. And they have questions, all sorts of questions, and everybody has lots of questions and they're genuinely curious. And I think sometimes we get stuck on when they ask something and we go, where did that come from? Like, that's so much misinformation. But if you actually unpack that question with somebody and go, well, hang on a minute, why do you sort of think that, or where did you get that from? We can learn a lot along the way as well. And it's not so much misinformation or they don't know anything or anything like that. It genuinely comes from a place that they just haven't been exposed to it. That's not where they've been brought up. And if you take me into any other industry, I'd be exactly the same too. Wow. And I'd probably ask some really stupid questions or some questions that come from a really random place as well. And people would be like, where is she coming from? But yeah, it's just coming from a genuine curiosity, and that's the same.
We've spoken about your passion and where you are now, but let's take it back right to the beginning. How did you start out? You mentioned you grew up on a property, and has that transpired into what you're doing and what are you doing?
Great question, Tip. So home is the family farm in southern New South Wales. So we're about 10 km from the Murray River. We're loosened hay producers, so on irrigation, most of our hay going into chaffing mills or into the local dairy industry. We also do some cereal cropping. So I guess that's the background. We've been here, mum and dad have been here 34, 35 years. And when I left school, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So I worked locally. I was in an accounting firm to start with and then loved the farming clients and was like, well, this is where I should have been, or I guess in ag. So I worked then in the local irrigation company, rolling out government programs, and then did my bachelor degree in ag business. So did that by distance. And then started the Lego Farmer, and that sort of took me on the journey of ag education. And since then, I've worked in Northeast Victoria in ag education roles in South Australia and also Central Queensland.
And now I want to talk a little bit more about the Lego Farmer Project. I know a lot about it, but some of the listeners might not. What actually is it?
So the Lego Farmer was literally me having a bit of fun, and it's actually just ticked over 10 years, which is kind of crazy that I still get to play with Lego. But I saw Lego photography is not an unbeknown thing. But for those who this is completely random, which it absolutely is, Lego photography is using Lego minifigures, so those 4 cm people that come in your Lego kits to showcase and take photos of them and showcase in a bigger world, I guess. I discovered Lego photography about 10 years ago, did some digging, and there was no one taking photos of a farmer and not a lot of actually taking photos outside. There were very much studio setups, lots of Star Wars, huge Star Wars contingent. But I was like, well, why not? Why isn't someone doing it as a farmer? And so back into that piece around irrigation, I just wanted a way to connect and showcase the diversity of Australian ag. And didn't really think about it being much bigger than just friends and family would get a kick out of it, would make us smile. I like macro photography. I like using something small to create a bigger picture. So yeah, sort of took photos and it's kind of snowballed from there. And it was that connection piece. It was people then connecting with me or using it as a tool in education that I kind of saw how that could be used potentially bigger than that. And that's taken me on a path of ag education.
And so I suppose it's led it to where you're now. I believe you're an NAFFIELD recipient, and you've just spent the last couple of years really immersed in this world of education. Tell me about your topic and what's that looked like.
So my NAFFIELD was looking at food and fibre education or agricultural education, particularly for primary school students. Those are the kids that I get a real joy out of their connection with ag and their curiosity. They don't roll their eyes at me like high school kids, where the little kids just get so excited too. So I looked at agriculture education in the primary school years, both in the classroom and then what we would classify not necessarily as agriculture education, but rather agricultural engagement that's beyond the classroom. So particularly like agricultural shows and agritourism, quite a large topic, and ag education is not unbeknownst into NAFFIELD research and that sort of thing. So it was really an extension of some of those other reports into ag education, but with a focus on those primary school years. So it's been an incredible couple of years looking at ag education and
Where
deep
have you
diving into
been?
that.
Where in the world have you been? And what are other countries doing that we need to do here in Australia?
Over the 2 years, I spent 7 months traveling overseas in about 3 separate trips. I went to 10 countries and also extensive travel domestically here in Australia. And I guess what are the other countries doing? For me, it all comes back to connection. And that's, yes, a great pun on Lego and being connected, but it also comes back to that real key piece. There were a lot of connected resources. So as a country or as a state, they were really connected, and their resources across the industry. Their industries themselves are really connected under the one umbrella of agriculture. And they were really strongly connected back to their consumer, being the teachers or the students who are using their resources. So for me, that really strong piece coming through was that connection. And that's something that's really, yeah, come through really strongly from what I've looked at.
And now I wanted to touch a little bit. You did mention it, your ag shows. So I know it's not just with your NAFFIELD, but I think that's how we met years ago in the ag show space. Why has that been an important part of, I suppose, who you are? I know, I loved seeing you and doing what you do in the ag show space, but and why are they important for ag education?
Hugely important for ag education at agriculture engagement as a piece, because as an industry, we're not the only industry that's knocking on schools' doors going, can you just put more of it in the curriculum? Can you just teach kids where their food and fibre comes from? And then all our problems will be solved. Every industry would love a space in the curriculum. Every industry would love an extra time. And teachers have got really tight curriculums. So as an industry, we need to take some ownership of this ourselves and actually look at what other things can we do beyond the classroom that actually fit a piece around ag engagement. And if something is really engaging and entertaining and of good quality, then it can be educational as well. Because if you have a good fun day out and you actually learn something along the way, then that's a really added bonus. So I love ag shows because I'm a passionate ag show volunteer, but I love because it brings it back to that education piece, but it's also that connection piece of our communities and our rural communities. It's usually the longest standing organisation that we've got in our local community, and it's that one event each year that you know when it's on, whether it falls on Father's Day or it falls on the long weekend or it's, you know, it's over Easter, you know when it is, and it brings everybody together.
I know when we were chatting about this interview, it was so interesting when you, like, I had never thought of it like that, that the ag show organisations usually have been there the longest. With that, would you say is that a good thing and a bad thing? Because I know, I suppose, like, Australia is crying out for volunteers. They just are. And it's a constant topic, I think, in every regional community, you know, every state. But it seems that ag shows, it's something that comes up even more, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. They are absolutely crying out for volunteers. I think every organisation from the fire brigade through to ag shows through, you know, everyone's crying out for volunteers. And it's an ageing volunteer base. And, you know, I've often sat on ag show committees where I'm the youngest, and not just the youngest, but the youngest by 30 or 40 years. But in saying that, they are very traditional, and sometimes we've got tradition to carry forward, but we've also got to make sure that our ag shows are not a museum, because that's not what we're trying to bring in with the crowd that comes through. And that was something when I travelled overseas, because you're travelling, and when you travel, you look at something because it's not in your backyard. So when I travel into a state fair in the US, I don't know what the top products that they produce in Indiana is versus the state next door. And that's really big for them. Their state fairs are really huge on telling you. So you should be able to walk out of that state fair and name the top five products that their state produces. I don't know what those are going in, because that's not my home country or my home state. They were really passionate about making sure our state fairs are not museums. If they have a showcase of old machinery, because that can, there could be a local club that does that, but they also have a showcase of new technology, and that people walk away knowing that our shows or our agricultural industry is not just old machinery, but there's new innovations coming through. And I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose that's what ag shows are about. They're about celebrating the region and celebrating the industry. But with that, it's, I suppose, you know, getting that balance right between, being progressive, because that's what ag is. Like, it really is, isn't it?
It is absolutely. And it's making sure you have that balance, and particularly when we come through that frame, if we put that frame into ag education. I use the example of the dairy industry because it's one that we're all really, really familiar with. And there would be examples across horticulture and livestock and every other sort of sector. But if you think about what we get kids to do when they come to an ag show, is that we get them to hand milk a cow. Now, I don't know any dairy farmers who hand milk their cows. And so I will always question when I go to an ag show, why are the children hand milking the cows? That won't help you get any labour to come and milk cows on your farms. What's really cool is that some of our farms now are using robots. Why isn't there a robot here showcasing that to the kids and showcasing those ones? And there was a couple of state fairs in the US that had that. They had the progression of the technology, so they're still showcasing that. They're still showcasing that you can hand milk a fiberglass cow. Then they had put the cups on, so a herringbone or a traditional sort of dairy, and then they had the robot so the kids could sit back and watch the robot. And when people go, oh, but, you know, it's really tactile for the kids to hand milk a fiberglass cow and, you know, squeeze the water out and whatever else, I'm like, yeah, but have you seen how enthralled they are by the fact the robot can do it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, it goes back down to that real food education, like understanding that the real processes involved in in what's involved in getting food from, you know, paddock to plate, I suppose. And I think it's a trap we fall into because it's what we see at our ag shows. We see that red American barn, you know, the kids dancing in the overalls. And because we see it all the time, we think that's what we need to do at our show. I've been guilty of it 100%. And yeah, it's something that it's just getting out, thinking outside that square.
Yeah, and thinking about what's in our backyard, what makes our area really interesting, what can we showcase? I remember it's not very far from me to Deniliquin, and when I went through their pavilion one year, it was obviously lots of rice were grown in that area, and they had a cup of cooked rice in their pavilion. And I was like, they were like, well, we've got rice in our industry, and there was no rice in normally in your home cooking area. And I was like, of course, like, where are we looking to our local areas rather than just always bringing on, well, everyone's got to have a fruit cake and there's a chocolate cake and then there's some shortbread, like actually going, well, hang on a minute, what are some other areas that we can bring in and making sure we're actually showcasing our local area?
And so that leads, I think, into my big question. This is a hard question, but I really want to know. And I think we've touched on it, but what makes a good ag show, in your opinion? I consider you like ag show professional. Like as someone who's like a fellow ag show volunteer, you know, what makes a good ag show now that you've seen them literally all around the world?
I think that local, that what makes your show a little bit different, what is that event that we know that we can only get when we go to the Deniliquin show or Berrigan show or the Ungerry show or whatever show it is, what is the only thing that's at that show? And it may only be one entry in a pavilion section, it may be only a pavilion class, or it may be, I pick on Ungerry, and because they have the fire brigade comes through and does a lolly drop on the main arena and all the kids come out. Like, what is that thing that makes that's your show, that's what your show is known for? And also making sure it's a real showcase of the best of agriculture and celebrates the things that are in your region. I think coming back to stuff that was really strong that came out when I was traveling, and it's really interesting the differences between what we consider a fair in US versus agricultural shows from the UK. So a fair in the US won't have any horse events. They'll use their main ring for parking cars. And I was like, what? That really took me by surprise. I was like, where are the horses? But huge, huge carnival sections, bigger than any carnivals I've seen here. And then when you go over to the UK, theirs is a combination of a field day and a country show. And so their audience is very much country audience. They don't expect the people that are coming through a state fair. In the US, they expect those people have never been on a farm. The UK expects that 75% of their audience are actual farmers. And they're going for a field day and they're going to get probably, you know, test out the next plow that they're going to purchase, their tractor, and they'll get their next outfits for the year and a new hat.
Yeah, I love that.
So for them.
Yeah, it's like balancing all the different shows and then attending. Yeah.
Yeah, so a show is very different depending on which country. I think Australia is a mix of what is the US state fair compared to a UK traditional agricultural show. And then we have what is only available in Australia, which is show bags, because they're an Australian invention.
I did not know that.
Well, there's a little bit of trivia. Came out of the Ecker. It used to be Freebies, and then it's very much a very much an Australian thing.
Oh, that's really cool. And so you think in regards to agricultural engagement, because I know ag shows are struggling, and I suppose it comes back to that volunteer conversation around like lack of volunteers, but do you still think there's a place in the ag engagement world for shows in Australia?
I absolutely do. I think we need to probably get a little bit smarter. We're a lot of small. So when I talk about a small country show, I'm talking about your 1 day, 2 day country show rather than, you know, your 10 day royal. And those, you know, in the US, they considered a small county fair to be 3 days minimum. And I was like, oh, that's not small. I'd love your crowds, please send them. But I guess what we have to come back to is how do we have an entry-level free experience and free entertainment when people come through the gates, that there's still that entertainment piece. And that's really hard in when we're a volunteer pool. So, you know, is there a role there for industry that we have some a collective of resources or a traveling exhibits that can sort of provide that gap, because we're all looking for, and cost of living is really highlighted, that show rides are really expensive. We're seeing less and less show rides turn up to those really small shows. And so we're constantly looking for free entertainment. Once we've got the people through the gate, we actually want them to stay as long as possible. And but we also want them to enjoy the day and maximize that and make the most of being able to go right around the show. And so how do we actually engage with that?
And my other question for you is, so volunteer, how tips are like being involved in so many different shows, you would have developed some skills or tips or something around like working with volunteers or handling volunteers. You know, what have you learned in your years of being in ag shows? Because I think it's relevant to the entire of regional Australia about that volunteer management.
I think whether someone comes to you on a committee or just wants to offer, you know, an hour or two on show day, or they want to come and do the working bees, grab them with both hands, but come at them where they're at. So not everyone wants to commit to a committee. Some people just want to be, you know, the labour on show day. And also if they come with you with an idea, give them the resources within means. Sometimes they need to go and seek the sponsorship so they can run what they want to do. But I found it really interesting when I moved to states that joining some committees were limited by numbers, and there was this real roadblock. But they were calling out, absolutely calling out for volunteers, but yet they weren't welcoming. And so I think we really need to be really careful about how we're perceived when people come to us. So, yeah, really thinking about that sort of that outset one. But, yeah, if someone comes knocking and go, you know, I'd really love to run an XYZ at your show, go, absolutely. You know, if you can source sponsorship, we've got the support for you. Give it a go. Give it a trial and really throw your support behind someone and give it its best shot, because it could be the next big thing at your show.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know where I read it. Maybe it was like a regional event thing, but they were saying you should be you should have 15% the same and then the rest different. And I was like, I don't know a single regional event that does that, because that's scary. Like sometimes trying. Yeah. And I was like, no, absolutely not. And I'm all for trying new things. The Catherine Show and Rodeo this year, and it was a lot to get across the line. We did speed dating and it was so well received from both a media perspective, because it was something different, but just a lot of young people were like, this was awesome, like something different. And it was that hard demographic of people to work with, it too young to like want to bake or be a part of the actual, you know, yep, show, too, you know, older. Yeah, it was just like it was so successful, but it was that just trying something new, and that can be really scary.
Yeah, and it's finding where your gap is and identifying who actually comes to your show. And sometimes that's really hard as a committee, because we're not the ones sitting idle on show day. When I was in the States, one of the committees there said to me, if you've got any time, stand on your gate and talk to people as they leave the show. Why did you come? What was your favourite bit? That sort of thing. You usually won't get negative feedback that you usually get that people post on Facebook or those ones. They won't usually say it to your face, and you'll get some really incredible insights. And you often, it's really hard. As a volunteer show, it's really, really hard to do. It's also being observant. So in my local one-day show, we are in school holidays and we're a grandparents and grandchildren crowd. So we do have some young families, but we have a lot of grandparents and grandkids. So we actually flipped one of our sections this year. We usually would have, you know, you decorate scarecrow and you bring it in. This year, our men shared made us what they call skeletons, but the scaffold of a scarecrow, we planted them on our sort of slope that goes down to where we would open the show. And right before the opening, we had all the items so that you could dress them, and we made it a team sport. And it was engaging, because you could come and do as a family unit, or grandparents with grandkids, or a couple of kids, or whoever. And yeah, that's the most scarecrows we've ever had decorated because they were all built there. But it was super, super engaging. But we looked at what was a category that was never entered or had very few entries, and what was something that we could flip. And I saw that idea at Tokel Field Day. So they were running that as a fundraiser. And went, you know what, that actually looks, and it fills a bit of space. It looks engaging.
Yeah. And you do need space fillers. That's a thing at a lot of shows. With entries, I know a lot of shows have said in the past few years they're struggling to get entries. Do you have any tips around that from, you know, your few years being immersed in the shows around the world?
Not huge, other than you have to keep evolving them. So yeah. Look at what's popular, look at what some other shows are doing, what is the latest craft trend, what are people entering? And it will surprise you about what things will get. You'll suddenly have a burst of things that'll come through in one particular thing. You go, well, we haven't had that being entered in for 3 years. And, you know, so what if that is? And then, yeah, I guess sort of backing it. So making sure that, I guess, your pavilion schedule in particular is not static. It constantly rolls and changes. And yeah, and it's really reflective of the community and thing. And don't be afraid to, I guess, add classes and add age groups or have an aged care section or really young kids. Or if there's a children's centre that's really engaged or a daycare or a school, just, I guess, fitting those in.
Prisons as well, actually, mm-hmm. are another good one I found quite, because they're like looking for activities to do. In so prisons, schools, rehabs, like
men yeah. shared, yeah, all sorts of. If you've got a really diverse community, one of the shows, I kept referring to the US, but one of the state fairs, because it was so different to ours, one of the state fairs had a multicultural section in their pavilion, so they didn't judge the suites against each other, but they had. Individual, you had to submit the recipe, but also the story. And so for that to even observe or to go into, it was really, really interesting. Now, obviously, you can't judge them against each other, but it was about sharing it. And it was a really, really cool. They also had an ugly cake competition, which I thought was really cool because everything's about the best thing. But this was kind of like failed cakes and then decorated to look like Halloween cakes. And it was based on people's vote.
I love that. And even if it's just, I remember a committee saying once that I was working with, like, oh, we don't like people votes because all people do is get their friends in to come and vote. But like in that situation, why does it matter? We're voting on an ugly cake. Like it's getting yeah. them engaged. Like it's that added layer of the show and it's funny. Yep.
And they've come to the show. So they've come
yeah.
in. And
win-win. Now I want to revert back a little bit to ag engagement, and you were saying at the beginning of your NAF field you traveled to lots of different countries to try and get your thinking outside the square. I want to talk about that. So what is that about and where did you go within that process?
With Nuffield, there's a couple of programs that are set, and then you have your own independent research. So Nuffield Scholarship is broken into three parts. So to kick it off, we have what's called a CSC or Contemporary Scholars Conference, and that's where all the scholars that are announced for the year. So there's about 60 scholars announced from around the world gather in one country, a Nuffield country, to get to know each other and build our network. So that was held in Canada in February. So it was like minus 24 degrees. I left home when it was 42. So Canada was the first trip. And then after that, I went to New Zealand. There was a triennial conference with Nuffield, but there's also some really great things happening in New Zealand in ag education. The second component of a Nuffield is a GFP or a global focus program. So you travel with other scholars between about 8 to 12 other scholars from different countries, and you go through 5 countries hard and fast over 5 weeks. And the idea of a global focus program is to not focus on your topic, but to focus on global agricultural trends, so production trends, economics, ag politics, all that sort of thing, so that we don't get stuck in our own topic and lose perspective of its wider impact on the world. So for me, I travelled with a group of 10 other scholars, hugely diverse. We had an insect farmer from Perth, and we had a beekeeper from Canada, a couple of sheep farmers from Australia, some regenerative farmers, so one from the UK and one from Zimbabwe, a Wagyu farmer from Japan, a number of other people. So huge diverse group. So you can imagine our conversations, even as the visits, but then there's that conversations that you're discussing with all those people as well. And we traveled through, so over 5 weeks, we did Singapore, then India, then Qatar, then Germany, and then the US. And then on my own travel, I guess yeah. that third component is independent research. And so I stayed on in the US after that trip. And then I did another trip, which was earlier this year, and I went to the UK, including Ireland, Denmark for Lego, and then returned back to New Zealand.
And so key takeaways from all of those, both, I suppose, not just in the ag engagement space, but overall, what were they?
Narrowing it down to just a couple of key takeaways is absolutely huge. It was incredible. The insights to that is just insane, like the conversations that we had and to be able to see ag in all those countries. But I guess the things that come out are that the things that we all have in common. So labour issues, every country we went to and every country that I went to on my individual travel all have labour issues, and that perceived social divide or what we would call in Australia a city-urban divide or a rural-urban divide. So these loss of connection, call it what you will. So those sort of social issues, and then the pressures of pricing and markets around the world, and what that looks like in different countries and what that may be, but also whether that's coming through from policy and politics, or in the UK through from Brexit and the EU and those sorts of things. But yeah, really, I guess, honed in that the world's a huge place and there's so many big differences. There's a lot of things that are the same that we're all facing together.
Yeah, Qatar. My ears prick up a little bit there as I work in the Love It Export space, and I've delivered sheep to there. Where did you go and what did you look at there?
So we went in the middle of summer. It was June. Yes. And we were mostly greeted with, why are you here at this time? It was hot. I think we averaged about 46 degrees in the day and to 36 at night. And I guess what we were looking at, it was a huge contrast. When I reflect on my GFP, I often say that India and Qatar were my absolute favourites. Mm. One, because of the contrast, but two, because of what I learnt from that, before that contrast. And they are not two countries that I would have picked to go for my topic and travel on my own as a single female. So the learning from those two countries was just immense. I guess my key takeaways from Qatar is that they're farming in the desert, so the innovation that they have there, although I add that with an appendium because, you know, they've got the money. But that flows through to the rest of us because they're innovating at that speed that we can then learn from that. And the other thing that really, really stands out is their food security. So their national commitment to that food security and the embedding and what we witnessed in that food culture as well. But particularly when you're importing all your food or the vast majority of it and a lot of it 12 months in advance and stockpiling it, that commitment to that food security and for the reasons that they have, like for the blockade and those sorts of things, it was just incredible.
I think people, when we talk about food security, and even farmers are guilty of it, they envision like starving people around the world, and they're like, oh, well, we've got to feed them, they're starving. And I'm like, and it's an incredible conversation to have with people. And I'm like, no, like they're not necessarily starving, but they just can't produce their own food like we can here in Australia. Unless you see that, it's really hard to sort of paint that picture, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a political thing. Like the reason why they've gone and built a dairy that's, you know, government owned is because that Saudi Arabia blocked the borders. And so they will, we'll produce all our own dairy. And it's like, okay, of course we will. Like, but to see that is just incredible. And like, yeah, it's, yeah, purely for food security and the thing, because they're bringing in all the feed for 12,000 head or up to 24,000 head of dairy cows 12 months in advance. Like, that's huge. And they've got to import the dairy cows in the first place. But yeah.
Yeah. And you touched on like culture around food, and you would have seen that in different countries around the world, not just, I suppose, in the Middle East. And I always find it really interesting because we talk about like ag engagement or ag education, and a lot of times we talk about schools and how it's the school's responsibility. But I know I something I love about like going Kuwait particularly, but also like the Middle Eastern countries, is the family culture around food. And I think people, there's a religion aspect, of course, but there's also the culture, you know, like around their food and the way, I suppose, that's influenced by religion. It's so much different to here in Australia. I'd love to, you know, hear your understandings or what you found, I suppose, traveling world, really immersed in that world.
Yeah, so us, we visited a feedlot, the unloading docks, and there wasn't a lot of animals there because it was the middle of summer, but they would normally have, you know, sheep being flown in from, you know, Syria and Lebanon. A lot of fat-tailed sheep were there at the time that we were there. There were some goats, I think they were from Somalia, and then there was some cattle in from Sudan. And then right next to that is the market pens. And so they're held there by shepherds. There's only pens on three sides because the shepherd is by every single pen. And beside that again is the meat processing works or the abattoir. And for us, it was really interesting to witness that it is really culturally embedded that the sacrifice of an animal. So it would be a family outing to collect your animal from the sale yards, purchase one from the shepherd, and then walk it across to the meat processing centre and witness that. So there's a waiting area in the abattoir. It's open until 12 o'clock for individual kills or consumer kills, and you can watch. There's a complete viewing gallery, and then after 12 it does wholesales or retail. But that idea that you would bring your children along, you would select the animal, you understand that process, and then you would take the entire animal home, including all red offal and its head, and it was really important to them that as you collected it, the animal was still warm, and that you collect all parts, and that they'd been there to witness it and to watch. When we were there, we saw a family come and collect an animal, and to see that process, it was really interesting, because that's completely different to how we might receive meat. And that's not going to the supermarket and just picking up a packet of lamb cutlets. That's really choosing how you're taking that animal's life. And then that's not done every day, because you're going to go home and you're going to feast on that, but then you're going to have all those components for a very long time. So yeah, it was really, really interesting that food culture is really so embedded.
Oh, absolutely. And it's even like Indonesia, for example. And I think that's a country like the wet markets or the fresh markets. It's so important for them, similar to one haggle. You know, that's part of the culture around their food, but that fresh product, you know, haggling for it, collecting it, respecting the animal and the sacrifice of that life so much that they don't want to waste a single element of that entire animal. And it's such a concept here in Australia. I find it quite funny, because here we are reverting back to farmers markets. You know, we're like, oh my gosh, it's really cool to like go to a farmers market and meet a farmer. And then over there, I was even talking to an Indonesian guy recently. He's like, and then you guys want us to have like supermarkets in Indonesia. Like, I come to you, and he's like, we've already got, like, I was like, you see what's wrong here? Like, we're going round and round and round. And then even like, I talk about Italy and that there's a whole food culture there in Italy that the Western world, we envy, I think, because, you know, that fresh product, knowing where your food comes from, the slow food movement, all of it. And it's an incredible thing, the way people consume food and families consume food. Like, can you imagine if we had an abattoir here in Australia for the average family to go and watch their animal get slaughtered? I don't, it would be incredible. I know it's a, you know, huge part of life. So to be able to teach that, it'd be amazing. I don't know. Maybe
it's just the food culture is so different. And it's interesting that you bring up Italy and some of those European countries where food culture is so, so strong. And yet some of those don't talk about the divide like we talk about the divide. Everyone talks about the divide being really, really wide in Australia. And we talk about local foods and bits and pieces and farmers markets and those sorts of things. And then they talk about, it's kind of, I've grown all of this within my backyard or within this local area, and I can say come within 5 kilometres and that sort of thing as well. So trying to, it's not our place to disrupt food culture in other areas. It's, it's a place to learn and to go, well, how can we actually embed that into theirs, and how does that impact, our society and our conversations that we're having?
Well, how does that? What's the answer to that question? What can we take away from, what you've seen around the world, and what can we bring back and implement here in Australia? Because I think there's people who want it, and I think there's families who want it. There's families who would love. I went to a farm open day down south, and they do it twice a year, and it's sold out both times, 200 tickets. And it was just, I went along and it was just families wanting their kids to see where they're genuinely craving that connection. So what is the answer to that?
It is. And I think that connection piece is really, really key. People want connection. They want an ability. And whether that means it's, I've been able to pat a potty lamb, or I've been able to go, oh, that's why that machinery that works that way, and that's why they're driving down the road, and that might slow us down on the school run tomorrow, or whatever it's been. It's that genuine connection and being able to put a face to a product, or to put it to a process. So rather than just going, oh, the farmers, well, actually I met a farmer and that person's name was X, and I can actually put a name and a story to that. And I think it's really interesting. We tend to have a lot of red tape and hurdles in Australia. So I know farmers would love to do more connections into schools or open days and that sort of thing, but there's barriers and they might be rightly there, but we seem to have more barriers than what they do sort of in other countries. And that's kind kind of, well, that sort of next step, well, how do we actually navigate through those and make sure processes are easier? And Australia's also a really big country, and we seem to have 7 sets of rules for every state. So a different set of rules. So what might work in WA, I might not necessarily be able to implement in New South Wales. And there's going to be these sort of different steps. So we get a project and we, how do we retrofit things that are working really well from other countries?
I think this goes back a little bit to shows. I remember I was doing with a classroom in Katherine in the Northern Territory, which is a state which is known for its beef. And people talk about city-country divide. And I remember being in this classroom and a kid asking me what a Brahmin was. And it was really, really interesting. And it's happened again in my local town. So we're just 15 minutes out of town. It's a town population of 1,000. And I think I always find it like funny. I'm like, it's not city country. Like it's more than that. Like it's even in us teeny tiny towns or your teeny tiny ag shows, don't underestimate the importance of like sharing it to everyone. And even I was just talking to someone from Tokyo about wool 2 hours ago, and I know nothing about like what they're doing over there or what the wool market is. And I'm someone who works in the ag industry. So it's just a conversation I think we always have to have, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, it's constant. And when I've moved into different states or different areas, I find absolutely fascinating. I think this is why when I went on my NAFTA, it didn't matter what farm we went to, like they're all so really interesting. But when I moved different states, so when I was in central Queensland, it was not very far from pineapple farms. Now, if you had told a person who grew up on an irrigation farm how to grow pineapples, I would have had absolutely no idea. But taking a school excursion to a pineapple farm, but the number of kids who were from the local school who were not very far from that pineapple farm who had never tasted fresh pineapples absolutely floored me. And I was like, wait, what do you mean you've never tasted fresh pineapples? Well, I'm so glad we've made your day and you get to taste them fresh from the farm today. Like it's those sorts of things as well that never underestimate what sort of impact you'll have. And when I delivered excursion out of Toowoomba, it was the first time a number of children in that class had ever stepped foot on a farm. Not only that, it was the farm that they drove past every week to go to soccer training. They knew where we were going, but yeah, it's
that's so important. I want to ask you about India quickly. So you said that was another one, a country that you found fascinating. Why? What did you go and look at in India?
As we were both in the south of India and also in the north of India, I guess the difference and the change in there and the intensity of agriculture as we went north, incredible, again, incredible food culture and just the smells and the taste of those, that food, and that it was just really, really incredible. And I guess the difference between India and Qatar, and I use this often as an example because it just sums up, I guess, the Nuffield and just the experience. We were in India, in the north of India, in Punjab for World Milk Day. They took us to a leading dairy and it had a herd of 48 cows. They all had collars on. Now, that's a huge dairy for India because most of them will only have one or two cows in it. You know, they take the milk into the town centre. And then not long after that was one of our last farm visits in India before we flew out to Qatar. And that's then when we went to their state-owned dairy, which has 12,000 head at that time but has capacity for 24,000 head. And the comparison between those two was insane. But also they were wearing the same collars. Those cows were all having the same technology on them. So it's just, we are all in one as an agriculture industry across the world. It just is the same. And then actually that dairy was not the biggest I visited. I went to a 36,000 head dairy in the States. It's between Indianapolis and Chicago and it's fully open to the public. It's pretty much a theme park. It was insane.
Amazing. You just mentioned food culture in India. I want you to paint a picture for me. So I've been to India, but I need to go back because I feel like I didn't immerse myself in it. What does that look like? Describe their relationship with their food then.
It means every meeting we were offered a cup of tea. Often we would, with our hosts when we were in the south of India, we would just be wandering through the village and be like, actually, my sister-in-law or maybe it's my uncle, he's just down here. We'll just pop in. And so, like, you're travelling with us, which is a group of 12 of us by the time we had an in-country host plus him. Like, I was like, you're just going to invite us all in? We invite us all in. There was cool drinks and the tea. Like their hospitality was incredible. And then, yeah, the feast that sort of at night was insane. And when they offer you a chai tea, you can watch them mixing all the spices and stuff. It was just incredible. And everything smelled amazing. It was diversity there. The layers in their farms of what they're producing was just incredible.
Oh, I love that. It's an incredible thing, I think, when you get to the nitty gritty of it around the world, just like food, we underestimate like people, it's been a part of people's lives and part of people's cultures for thousands and thousands of years, you know, it's a part of who they are really. And and their identity. And I don't think we can ever underestimate that.
Yeah, and what brings us together, it's what we share. Like, it's that connection piece. It's such incredibly powerful thing. It's just so incredible that it's, yeah. And then the agriculture embeds all that. We get to all make that and grow that. And you can go to another country and still be talking about your rainfall and how you grow something. And there's that common language. It's just really cool. Whether we're doing that through a translator or not, like it's, yeah, to see people light up when you ask them about, well, what have you done here? Like, why is that growing so well? And what's that so cool? Like, it's just really cool.
And people like farmers too. You know, if you, like, when, like, you go somewhere, and even I've been in countries where there's been this massive language barrier. And I would say I'm a trainee farmer. I'm working really hard to like earn my official farmer title, which I'm a farmer. That's why I'm so interested. And they're like, then they're like, you're in, like, you're right, like, they, I don't know, it doesn't, don't know what it is about being a farmer, but wherever you are, they seem to love, I get it, like, I, you know, like, come and have a look at my chooks, like,
yeah, that's why you ask me about the weather and this and that.
Yeah. I love that. Well, I think we've summarized so much, but your report, you've done your Nuffield report, and is there anything else you want the world to know that's within that report, you know, that you, some really, that we might not have discussed today, or what you want the takeaway message to be from this podcast episode?
So just a small question, Tip, just a small one.
I know. I said to you earlier, I was like, oh, I'll send you through some questions. And then I've just gone completely off script because it's like, oh, that's really cool. Like, what are you doing there? What did you do?
I guess for me, the key takeaways are for agriculture education and engagement, we need really long-term investments. So coming back to the school piece or the teacher piece, we don't need short-term programs. We need to be able to lock these things. If agriculture wants a place in the curriculum, we need to be able to lock agriculture into the curriculum and be able to go, okay, that's a program that I can rely on and it's going to be placed in. I'm going to do that, you know, week five, term two, and I'm going to lock it in. It's always going to be there for me. And we have a problem with short-term funding at the moment. But the other thing is really modern, transparent programs, programs that we constantly update, that we don't create, then we sit it on a shelf and go, done that. Industry can give us ourselves a big tick and a pat on the back. No, we actually need to always revisit them. There's some really strong examples overseas of constantly auditing their programs, checking them, making sure everything links correctly, that's always there. It's a great representative of the industry. So those sort of things. And then coming back to that connection piece, are we always connected to that end consumer, the teachers that are using our resources, the students who are using our resources, connected as a whole industry rather than always siloed, and that we're inclusive and accessible and making sure that everyone can get the messages that we want them to.
I love that. Thank you so much. I know I have learned so much. Every time I talk to you, I feel like I walk away with, I don't know, more to think about. So is there anything else you want to add?
No, I think this has been great. Thank you very much for having me on, Tip. I really enjoy your podcast. And so thank you for having me.
No, thank you. And I'll be, I don't know, keeping an eye out for any of your findings out in the world, I think, from your years as a Nuffield. I'm actually looking forward to reading your report. So that'll be cool.
Well, the report will be out by the end of the month, so it's October. So hopefully by the end of the month, it's sitting with Nuffield Australia at the moment. And I also, because I know that we don't all love sitting down reading a 10,000-word report, I actually recorded mine as an audio because everyone loves a podcast. So if you can handle my voice for any longer, you can listen to the report as well.
No, and look, for so many hours driving, I think that's awesome, actually. That's a great idea. Where will people be able to find that?
The link to the audio will be inside the report.
Okay.
But when I actually share it, when it all goes public, I will be posting both because I think the audio makes it much more accessible. So
I'll make sure I link it in the bio. So no, thank you once again for joining us. No, I've learned so much.
Thanks for having me, Tiff.
Thank you so much again, Amy. And as always, if you know someone who you want to know more about, let us ask all the nosy questions, as we would love to share their story.